very excited about what's coming up. American Indian poet, musician, and activist John Trudell visited the Bay Area recently as an artist in residence at the Intersection for the Arts in San Francisco, where he gave readings of his work and heart talks in small, intimate settings. Here in a conversation with actor-activist Peter Coyote, Trudell discusses his personal genius as a key player in the American Indian movement, highlights defining moments of Native American struggles, and shows us how to recreate our language to re-empower us all in the face of today's monocultural monolith. We start out with Peter Coyote. Here it is. This was recorded, I should say, 1 month ago at Intersection for the Arts in San Francisco. Here's Peter Coyote.
Wow, thanks a lot. It's a full house. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a pleasure to be here with my pal, John. And I want to tell you a couple of working assumptions I'm going to make for the evening and kind of give you a shape of it. The evening is designed really to introduce you to John and kind of a lot of the tendrils of his life, which are emblematic of larger issues. So at the risk of making false assumptions, I'm going to assume that this is largely an urban and white audience that may not be as conversant with some of the finer points of Indian history, Native struggle in the United States. So I'm going to take about the first half of the evening and address that to kind of give everybody a common background. And then the place where John and I really come most common is as artists. And so from that point, I'm going to lead the conversation, or hopefully elicit responses, that will talk about the relationship of culture to politics and the posture of the artist. So that's going to be the kind of shape, and in the course of doing that, I'm going to refer to my notes. John, just kick it off on a common, just tell us a little bit about where you were born, tribal affiliation, just a quick thumbnail sketch of your childhood and sense impressions of what politics and life was to 20 or 15.
Well, I was born in 1946 in Omaha, Nebraska. And my tribe is Santee, Dakota, Sioux. And my reservation is Santee, and it's up in northeastern Nebraska. And until maybe about the time I was around six, I lived on a reservation. And then my mother died then when I was six, so maybe after about a year or sometime period of time like that, we moved to Omaha, to the city. And then basically from that time until I was about 17, I lived maybe half of my life in the city and half of my life on the reservation. So I was living two different realities. And I learned to adapt to both realities. And
what was the reservation reality?
What was it?
I mean, well, give us an emblem of like the reservation reality. Where,
well, the reservation reality was really that, you know, we were, there was no class system. We were all poor. It's that simple. And there weren't a lot of people at that time. I mean, you know, there weren't very many people. Well, there just weren't a lot of people on the reservation at that time. And so, you know, we didn't have, I live with my grandparents a lot. And we, you know, we didn't have electricity or running water or indoor or anything, you know. And we had to cook and heat by wood. We had to haul water, you know, do these kinds of things. But everybody was just really, really was poor. But there was a sense of community that existed there that did not exist off the reservation. See, off the reservation, everybody had more, right? But the sense of community wasn't there. That was where, you know, that right. Was indigenous to my own reality, I guess.
What about the sense of common culture on the reservation versus the city?
Yeah, well, that's what I mean by the sense of community. It's
Okay.
we're all, you know, our culture, this is who we are, you know. And you know, so it's like, you know, I mean, I guess in one way, you know, everything was shared pretty much, you know. And I mean, in the sense of, you know, nobody had much, but if somebody came, they got fed.
Can you remember an incident or something that sparked a political understanding or opened a political lens, a way of looking at the world in your childhood?
When my mother died.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm looking back,
mm-hmm.
right? But it opened, it raised a religious question, right? Which I come to understand later is really a political question under the reality we're in.
Mm-hmm.
Because I wasn't brought up with religion. Although my mother was a Catholic and I was baptized as a Catholic, but she died while I was young.
Mm-hmm.
So and after that, I never had religion put to me,
mm-hmm.
right? But when she died, I'd been told about God, and I didn't trust him,
mm-hmm.
right? Just plain and simply put, I didn't trust him, because there was nothing I could understand or comprehend about him. So I didn't trust, and after that, it made me start thinking, when I look back on it, is that I started to understand, there's a certain unfairness that exists in life. And then I got that from that sense of that happening,
mm-hmm.
see, and off the reservations. Yeah, I didn't think of it. See, I never thought of anything in political terms until maybe I was a man, right? Or until I was much taller. Everything else was just what I saw, and that's what it was, at the time. But the thing I noticed about off of the reservation, right, is that number one, racism was a real deal. And class was a real deal. Although I didn't relate to it in terms of class, it was, that some people got a lot and some people don't have anything or have, hardly enough. See, but I became conscientious of these realities, young. And by the time I was a teenager, it had manifested to, I knew that, by the time I was a teenager, that life on the reservation was that the people I was running around with, right, so we were drinking and just having a good time and doing things, right, but I was running, so when I'm a teenager, 15, 16, I'm running with people who are my age and into their 20s and 30s, see, and somewhere out of all of that running, right, I realized these people are my partners because there's nothing for them to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing here, right, and I understood that, and I understood that the reality was I needed to get out of where I was at because we were young and we were drinking and just partying and not doing anything bad, but just being young. But I knew that if the state got us, we would go to prison for something.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that was the option.
That to me was that was the option. I was going to end up in prison. There was no doubt about it.
I think the first time that I heard of you or that we met was in some incident surrounding Alcatraz. How did you get from Omaha to Alcatraz, either physically or mentally? You can make that as short or as
I kind of went around the world almost.
Uh-huh.
Right? So in order to get out of there, I went into the military. And this was in 1963. And I went into the military to get away from where I was. It really had nothing to do with patriotism or any kind of loyalties like that. It was I needed to go somewhere, because right, I wasn't going anywhere there. And I picked the Navy because I figured, because I look back on it, I made a conscious, intelligent decision, right, in my confusion. because I picked the Navy because I thought, there's no war going on now, but what if there's a war starts while I'm in there? And if I'm in the Army or the Marines, I'm going to get a rifle in my hands and in the front lines. I didn't want that. And it turned out that there was a war that happened, right? And they didn't have any Navy. So it was a good decision on my part. So anyway, but I didn't adjust to the military. I didn't like the military.
Really?
No. Yeah, right. No sense to me. But I got in a lot of trouble, and I had court marshals, and I had all this stuff, right? And then they were going to kick me out, and then I thought, that defeats my purpose, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So I straightened up enough to make it through. And then I went from there to college. This was in 67. I got out of the military, and I went to college for a little while, right? And I didn't make it there either. But in every given situation, whatever what I was learning is that whatever it took for me to make it in the outside world, I was going to have to give them something of me that I didn't want to give them. Right? See, and that's really what it was, and that's why I couldn't fit into the system, because I had an attitude about that. Right? And so this is what led me to Alcatraz, because by the time Alcatraz came along, you know, everything was happening, and I had dropped out of school because I got pissed off at something that happened there. You know, I'm done with this, you know. And I was sitting, and I spent the summer and early part of the fall of 69. I was in school, but it was to get GI money, right? So it was, you know, so I have some income. Anyway, I spent the summer smoking pot, you know, and talking with this Armenian friend of mine and telling him, I don't know where it is I'm going, but I just got to wait. I remember having these conversations.
So you're 23 then?
I was 23. And then Alcatraz opened up. And I went there, and I knew this is where it's at. See, because in a way, what Alcatraz was to me, I had spent basically by then, this was 69, so I had basically spent by then maybe 6 years away from the native community into the outside world. You know, and whatever it was I was looking for, it wasn't there. I tried what they had, and it wasn't there. None of it fit. And then so when I went back to Alcatraz, here it was like walking back into my own community. It just, the community was shaped different now than it was a different reservation, you know.
A lot of the people in this audience are young. Why don't you give them a thumbnail sketch of the legitimacy behind the takeover of Alcatraz and what it meant symbolically to the native community?
Well, symbolically to the native community, it was like a rekindling of us, of our spirit, you know, and it was like showing us that we are here, and we all feel the same. It was a forum where everybody got to see we're still here, you know, and we're still real. And I think that was the symbolism. So to me, it was like a rekindling of the spirit. That whole activist period to me was like, that was one of the things that was accomplished by the activist period, was to rekindle the spirit of the people, because somebody was busy pouring water and sorrow on it.
Correct me if I'm a little wrong, but there's some charter under the law that unused federal lands.
Right, yeah, all right. See,
okay.
So we went to it under the 1868 Fort Laramie Treaty, and what we were saying at the time is we have a treaty right to reclaim this land, because it's written in this treaty about reclaiming unused federal land. And that was how we related to it at the time. And every issue that we ever got involved with politically after that was really around treaties. We may be talking about social issues, but basically it was always around the treaty. But when I look back on it now, what we were really, really talking about, but we couldn't articulate it at the time, was we were talking about law. See, because in reality, America claims to be a nation of laws. See, and I personally think that that's a lie. I personally know it's a lie, right? Because to be a nation of law, then all law must be equal. That's just the way that it is, right? Now, when we look at America's laws, there's common law, criminal law, constitutional law, statute law, and treaty law. But of those laws, anytime they say it, see, they'll say constitutional law. They don't drop the word law. They don't drop it after statute law or common law or criminal law, but when it comes to treaties, they drop the word law. So in reality, what we were saying to America is you have a legal responsibility. It isn't about your morality. You have no morality. It's about your legal responsibility. All right? If you're to be a nation of law, then you have a legal responsibility to fulfill these national and international legal agreements that were made between us as people and you as people. Yeah, and that's really what it was about.
Between sovereign nations.
Between sovereign nations. See, so it's about law. So I come out of Alcatraz understanding, all right, America isn't about law.
Okay. I learned that lesson right there. Law is a perfect hook. So in 1972... there were a series of caravans that were going to go to Washington, and they were going to educate Native people along the way. And during that time, Richard Oakes got killed. And a number of groups decided to go and demand that the FBI investigate his murder. They didn't want the rednecks where he was killed to investigate. Richard Oakes was one of the seminal figures from Alcatraz. And if I'm right, that was kind of the beginning of the Trail of Broken Treaties. And would you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, Richard was murdered by somebody. YMCA camp taker or something, someone to take caretakers of some respectable organization. And it was during that time, the Trail of Broken Treaties. And what the Trail of Broken Treaties was really about was we were going to take Native people to Washington, because the decision had been made earlier that year that this is as aimed, the American Indian Movement, as aimed that we were going to stand and face the Bureau of Indian Affairs, because whatever the social problems we were being confronted with, I mean, the American government, this is about the laws called treaties, right? But the Bureau was the one that's administering many of the programs. So this was really to take grassroots Native people to Washington, D.C., and we did it by caravan. It was the Caravan of Broken Treaties, and we had a 20-point position paper which was saying how we felt that these treaties could be fulfilled, ways that they could start to fulfill these treaties, keep these legal agreements. And when we got, and agreements had been made with people in Washington, D.C. from the bureaucracy that they would help us for housing and that they would do certain things. But when we got to D.C., see, then they didn't do any of these things. So basically, we're in a situation where we've got all these people, and we were inside the BIA building, and we have all these people, no way to take care of them, so we just occupied the building. And see, and that was not the intent. There were some who went, who wanted very much for that to happen. There are people who went there with the intention of occupying that building, but it would not have happened, all right, unless everybody had this need to happen. See, and there were people who didn't go there with that intention at all. It just kind of happened.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I had always been told that y'all went to black churches first. The only people that offered you shelter, yes, in Washington were black churches, but they were so funky that people couldn't stay, and that you were told to go to the BIA building and wait, and an auditorium was being prepared.
Yep.
And while you were there, you were attacked by GSA officers.
Well, see, what happened was, while we were there, see, because I forget all the little things, but I do remember is, yeah, we were attacked. Right? Remember that part?
Well, that's kind of an important part of the story,
yeah.
John.
But what it was is, see, they were closing. It was time to close, and they wanted us to leave. But by that time, we were in the commissioner's office relaxing, so, you know, we weren't going to leave, you know, because there was no situation outside of there to adequately take care of us. It was a situation where we would be just hustling people and tired, and, you know.
Right. You had elders with you?
We had elders. We had all the ages, yeah, from the old to the young.
And so
we were representative of the people.
And you were suddenly stuck in a federal building, in possession of a federal building,
yes,
with all the files of the,
yes,
Bureau of Indian Affairs. Were these at all useful?
They were to some people, right? Many files were taken out, yes.
Yeah.
Right? And
now, whatever happened to that 20-point position paper? It's something I've always wondered.
Well, welcome to the group.
Uh-huh.
What happened to it?
You know,
no, I mean, it's still around. No, well, obviously, it was never acted upon.
Right.
All right, so, you know, and it's still around, and I mean, people can get access to it through the website, through whatever, but I mean, as far as it being acted upon, nothing ever really came out of that.
Now, at the Bureau of Indian Affairs, there was a press conference, and there were basically three people that were kind of at that press conference, and it was Dennis Banks and Russell Means and Sid Mills. And this was kind of when the American Indian Movement came to prominence, because Dennis and Russell kind of took that position. They sort of took the microphone and they put the kind of the stamp of the American Indian Movement over the occupation. I'm a little curious as to how you see the relationship of AIM to other Indian sovereignty issues, where they come together and where they're divergent. Because I think a lot of people in the public think that AIM represents all Native struggles and issues. It's sort of like the warrior arm. And is that true?
Well, I mean, in a theoretical sense, yes, AIM does represent all Native struggles. But they're not in charge of all Native struggles.
Right.
They don't call the shots, because every Native struggle represents all Native struggles. So in that sense, I mean, there's not a separation, can't be separated. But a lot of times, when it was the AIM momentum that was making everything move, then it came under, in a way, it got identified as being AIM.
Because it was useful.
Yes, because it was useful. And see, and in a way, AIM, you know, the American Indian Movement at that time, in a way, you know, it was its own organization, right? With, you know, and it had its own leadership or its own structure. And at that time, you know, because we were still identified, this was before we were Native Americans, we were still American Indians, right? See, so it was also an American Indian Movement in the sense of that other groups did come into this umbrella and act at times. You know, and however, you know, whatever personal attitudes and personality struggles come out of clash and things like that, well, that's just human, that's just our behavior, right? But the overall thing was these things kind of had it, you know, because that's what I think made AIM so it may be difficult for the government, see, because number one, our legal position was 100% proper, because we were talking about the law, all right? And they knew that better than we understood it, because we were saying it in the terms of treaties, right? And the other part was, see, there was a certain rigidity to us because we created as a national organization, but there was also a certain fluidity, right, to it also, because we didn't all answer to one another, right?
Right, of course.
We got along for whatever reason, but that didn't necessarily mean we all hung out together and did all that stuff, right?
Now,
so we had room.
This is not something I know with my own eyes, obviously, but I was always delighted. There was always a rumor that there was a suitcase with $60,000 worth of cash.
$66,500.
Why don't you tell that story?
I know how much it was, right? Because I want to tell you, this is my version of it, right?
That's cool. I'm not going to challenge you.
My version of what happened. I'm not going to name names, but I will give you my version. All right? When this all happened, when the decision was made to negotiate with them for amnesty, all right, because that was one of the decisions that was made, all right, and a way out. All right, and actually, if I remember this correctly, the government may have offered the idea of the way out money, all right, to help get people out. And the figure ended up becoming 65,000, or whatever that figure was, right? And when it got to that, see, then these discussions, because you got all these groups and people now jockeying for position because we want to get out of town.
Money does that.
Yeah, it does, you know, and that's why they gave it, right? So anyway, it got decided that this person was going to take this much of the money because they led this part of the caravan, and so then they would take care of the people on the way back, right? Other people had this attitude it should be divided differently. So, I mean, money does what it does, right? So that all went on, and Bob Free gave me $2,000 and said, go to the bank, make change for it. So I did. I changed it into mine and split, took care of my people, and got the hell out of Dodge, right? Because that's what was going on, right? Well, I brought people here, you know, I didn't want any of the money. I was never at the time, but I had people all of a sudden under this system that was being divided. There are going to be people that aren't really the people that need help that aren't going to be able
that's
to get
right.
it if they're not with these main groups.
That's exactly
right.
Yeah,
so I got
heard.
My people out of there is exactly what I did.
So after D.C., I get the names mixed up, and you straighten it out. But I remember two shootings. I don't remember the order. There was Yellow Thunder, and there was Bad Hand Bull. And I remember a bunch of people went from D.C. to Rapid City. I remember three white guys in a bar, killed an Indian, made him dance, killed him, put him in the trunk of a car, and they were acquitted by a jury. And a bunch of people, I think Russell went then, to Gordon, Nebraska, maybe.
Yeah, Russ, Dennis, Ames went, yeah.
Okay, so maybe tell us that story. Tell us what you remember about that. Because I'm moving us up toward the present.
Right, all right, well, see, after we left the BIA building, all right, this is when the Bad Hat and Bull killing took place, if I remember correct, or Bad Heart Bull, right? Killings took place, and yeah, and these guys got away with it. These white guys killed him and got away with it. And AIM came in to protest that and to deal with that. And at the same time, on Pine Ridge, because it's very important to see, when the government had to let us go from the BIA building, because see, they couldn't take us on there, because we were in a media capital. It would be another Alcatraz, but this time it would have been much more. It would have been a different kind, another Alcatraz, because they'd have had to fight us there. We didn't have weapons, but we had our art. And they'd have had to fight us right there, all right? So they made this other deal to get us out of there because they needed to get us into hostile territory where they could wage this war and now seriously go after AIM, because AIM had embarrassed the Nixon administration. See, the stakes greatly elevated, more than we really understood at the time. So they started creating a certain environment in Pine Ridge. The FBI arrived in Pine Ridge in January of 73, all right, to train the police and counter
counter-subversive anti-terrorism, whatever it is, they trained them, they started arming them, seeing, and after the arrival of the FBI, then the levels of violence started now to dramatically increase. The killings, all the violence increased after the FBI got there. So what they were doing is they were drawing AIM in now, because get AIM tied up and locked up in a war out here in South Dakota where nobody's their ally.
Just to put it in perspective, in 1974, the highest per capita murder rate in the United States was the Pine Ridge Reservation.
So when all this was going on, the Bad Heart Bull killing happened. So anyway, AIM was in Custer protesting what was going on, all right? And then there was a big confrontation, a fight. The courthouse was damaged in some kind of a way. And
they had this, down.
Yeah, no, the Chamber of Commerce building burned down.
Oh.
All right, so this led into this whole thing, and then that happened, and then it was not too long after that that the occupation of Wounded Knee started.
Right. Russell went to Custer City, South Dakota. The courthouse, the building was burned. Then Pedro Bissonnette, if I remember, called the Oglala Civil Rights Group, called all around the country for help, and AIM was in the media because of the BIA takeover, and they were publicizing issues, unemployment, fraudulent elections. On the Pine Ridge Reservation, there were government-sponsored Bureau of Indian Affairs police. Dick Wilson and the Goon Squad were killing campaign organizers and basically what the Contras were doing in Guatemala and in Nicaragua. They were killing Democratic workers. And there was a meeting, and everybody said they were going to meet in Pine Ridge, but they didn't. They went to
Wounded Knee.
Mm-hmm. So talk about the occupation of Wounded Knee. Would you like some water? Thank you very much. Thanks a lot. Did you give John one?
Yeah.
Oh, this one was John. Sorry. Yeah. Well, talk about Wounded Knee and the occupation there.
Well, the occupation, again, was made to restate. It had to do with the conditions that now existed in Pine Ridge, the violence and just the government war that was being fought there, that was starting to be fought there. And it was, again, about the treaty law. And once again, because the 20-point position papers also got pushed again during this occupation of Wounded Knee, all right? And because this became a negotiation point later on. But the thing that I find the most interesting about Wounded Knee, all right, is that during the Wounded Knee occupation, through Reader's Guide, through TV Guide, which is the most widely read publication in America, right? In the TV Guide poll, there were more Americans supported the AIM, armed takeover of Wounded Knee, then supported the existing government sitting in power at that time, which was Richard Nixon. See, and the thing I noticed out of Wounded Knee, see, this has got serious political implications to people like Nixon and to government in general. See, so we were waging whatever our struggle was from within Wounded Knee, because it turned into this firefight, this long, prolonged, sporadic firefight. You know, Frank Clearwater was killed, Buddy Lamont was killed from our side, a marshal was paralyzed on the other side. You know, and many people were wounded, you know, and it was an occupation, and everyone, all of the people in the occupation were completely surrounded by federal forces, and the military was involved, and all, I mean, it was a war, you know, it was in whatever year that was, 1973 rather than 1873, and the war was just fought by the way it's fought now rather than what it was then, because numbers changed, technology changed, but it was the basic same behavior pattern.
I mean, I think for people who have come of age, let's say since Reagan was president in the 80s and through two terms of Bush and two terms of Reagan, it probably seems incredible that 23-year-olds were standing off the federal government, and that people were out in the streets by the hundreds of thousands and millions protesting the war in Vietnam, and the government took us a lot more seriously. We didn't know how powerful we were. If you listen to Nixon's tapes, they thought that we were organized and much more together than we were. And just to spread this out a little bit, John,
mm-hmm.
at the same time, why don't you just explain a little bit about, here Wounded Knee was a very symbolic act, even though it was life and death. Alcatraz was a very symbolic act. done to highlight medical, political, legal issues. Why don't you talk a little bit about the shootouts at Puyallup or Nisqually over the fishing rights, and like get down to some other bread and butter issues that were also going on in Native territory.
From what I know about it, what I can remember about it, because I didn't take part in that.
But you made bail for a lot of those people.
Yes, there was. This would have been in around 70s. But what started happening up there around the Squally and Frank's Landing was this was going on like in, if I remember it correctly, around like the mid 60s before Alcatraz even happened, that this struggle had started up there
over fishing rights.
Mm-hmm. If I remember this correctly, it was that this was going on before Alcatraz.
Okay, why don't you explain the issue a little bit?
Well, basically, again, it's back to the treaties, the laws called treaties. The people up in Washington had these treaty agreements, these legal agreements made with the government, right, about the fishing, their access to the recognition of their right to live off the fishing and the hunting and to do the resources in the way that they would use them. But the state had basically passed laws saying that they couldn't do it. So, I mean, there was like, people died in that one, you know, Ellison Bridges, you know, and it was a protracted one. It went on for a long time, the best I can remember it. I mean, it went on for years before there was finally some type of a resolution to it.
The Bolt decision, right?
Yes, it was around the Bolt decision, actually, that I think that changed that, right?
Basically, the Indians were given the right, guaranteed by treaty. These were people, by the way, who were not always vanquished by warfare.
Not given the right.
Won the right.
No, our right to do this was recognized.
Right, okay. Anyway, so the right to subsistence hunting and fishing came into direct conflict with sports fishermen and commercial fishermen who objected to the percentage of the salmon run that they saw as a set-aside to Native people. And this went on till the Bolt decision, which basically upheld the right of the Puyallup people to 50% of the harvest, and then also finally gave the tribes a say on anything that impacted the purity of the river.
Recognized their say.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay. Okay. I'm trying to keep this all coherent. It's a big...
Well, I'm not going to help.
No, you're not going to help. So, we're kind of... Let me ask you a question. Why do you think it is that Indians seem to have achieved much more business autonomy and land recognition from Republicans? Under Nixon, Ford, they got the Taos Pueblo, got Blue Lake back, the Yakima got Mount Adams. Why is it that it seems consistently that a guy like Nixon was revered by the Taos people for giving back sacred land, and they don't get that kind of support from the Democrats?
Well, maybe we were raising more hell during the Republican years. I don't remember exactly when what happened, but I think in some ways, well, I don't know, because see, I've never really looked at one side giving us anything that's going to be to our long-term advantage that they don't plan on taking away later in some way, shape, or form. So when certain of these things happened, you know, like I know when this happened around the land with Nixon, a part of that was because of the Alcatraz occupation, right? Because they didn't want to recognize our right to have that land, so they made concessions in other ways.
Right? So now, around this
time, some of it was trade-off, right?
Around this time, the environmental movement was coming into full swing after Kent State. A lot of people look at that as a beginning of the environmental movement, kind of gaining a firm ground in the white community. Mm-hmm. And there's a funny and oftentimes uneasy relationship, sometimes parallel, sometimes conflictual, between Indian culture and environmental community. For instance, there's been a lot of conflict about the traditional taking of whales by the Makah people.
Sea shepherd's wrong.
Yeah, well, talk about it. Explain what it is.
And the environmentalists that opposed that and raised all this hell about it, you know, they're wrong.
Well, I happen to agree, but explain the issue.
Because, you know, a part of the whole process of technologic civilization is to erase our memories to our ancestral past, because it's almost a way like kind of spiritual severing us from our beginning when we no longer have those memories. And what the Makah are talking about is hunting this whale, doing this thing symbolically. It's something that their ancestors did. It keeps them linked physically as well as spiritually to their ancestral past. And this is where all of our knowledge and our strength as human being comes from, is from our ancestral past, because it's a spiritual relationship to reality. So these people that are environmentalists, and they may be well-intended and good-intended, but, you know, they get lost in the political illusion of reality sometimes, you know, and manifest that confusion, maybe well-intended, right? But the result is not coherent, you know, because, you know, whoever it is that wants to change us from being who we are, they're wrong. Okay, what the rationalization is. Some, you know, somebody did it in the name of God and for the Bible, you know? That's the difference.
Right. Well, the environmental community is probably no more coherent than the native community. There's a radical conservative faction that says not one more whale. There's another faction that's kind of going to native people and saying, teach us the right way to do it. What do you think about that?
Show some respect. It's the right way to do it.
Yeah, well,
I mean, really, show some respect. Maybe we have to learn what that is, because that is the right way to do it. Show some respect. Maybe we have to learn how to show respect to ourselves in order to get what I'm saying, but it's about showing respect. That's really is the right way to do it in life, is to show some respect. Well, not give any. And it's becoming so pervasive that people no longer remember what respect means. See, and I don't know how to tell you, you know, dance this way to do it or pray this way. I can't say that, because that's not my position. See, but to me, it's like, it's about showing some respect. I mean, yeah, that's the ancestral reality. That's how we as human beings lived in harmony with the earth for so long. We showed respect.
So here we are. Mm-hmm. We're sitting here in San Francisco. You're wearing Birkenstocks. Sunglasses.
No, actually, they're not. They're Osolo Mio.
Okay. Whatever it is. So we've been kind of out there for a long time. I think a lot of people are probably wondering, what is an Indian? Is it blood? Is it philosophy? I've seen blonde, blue-eyed guys that can't speak English. I've seen full-blooded native people who can't speak Sioux. How do you think about that?
An Indian, you know, like, words are sounds, right? It's like a thought put into the vibratory world, and therefore, because it's like stone in the water, it has a meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And see, Indian is a mining word. That sound, that noise, because that particular sound is a noise, that noise was never heard on this hemisphere by my ancestors 30 generations ago. They never heard that sound.
Mm-hmm.
Indian? They didn't hear that sound of Native American either. They didn't hear that sound. They didn't hear the sound of God. They didn't hear any of these sounds. Those sounds, those noises, those sounds that became noises were never heard here. So Indian, this is a figment of someone's imagination, all right? Because it's almost like, see, we have been invisible since the Europeans got here. We remain invisible today in this sense. See, we are human beings. We're the people. This is what we told Columbus when he got off the boat. We're the people. We're the human beings. Columbus didn't understand it, because it was no longer a part of the descendants of tribes' perceptional, it was no longer a part of their perceptional reality, what it meant to be a human being, all right, or a people, because they were serfs and peasants and had been owned for 1,000 years already. See, so when we look at it here, so the history of the Indian, the reality of the Indian begins with the arrival of the Europeans. The only history the Indian has is one of genocide being waged against him. Right? Now, the history of the people of this land, the native people, and when we look at the history of the native people, all right, then the history of the Indian, right, is just a part. It's something that can be endured and outlasted, because, you know, the predatory world we're in, this is the predator we have to evolve a defense against, this kind of thing that has been after us for the last 500-600 years. See, so Indians don't exist. See, we're the people, the human beings. So sometimes, see, so when people are fighting over who's more Indian, see, okay, you know, swing away, you know, but you're missing the point. Because that's not who we are. And it's very crucial, because, see, one of the purposes of technologic perceptual reality is to erase the memory. So if they change our identity, they're erasing a memory. It's an ancestral memory. See, that's what happened to the tribes of Europe. See, because, you know, as long as we were tribes, no matter who we were, when we were tribes, see, we knew who we were, we knew what our purpose was. We had this memory. See, but now, but once the people lose their memory, their ancestral memory, once that memory is erased by civilization, then the people find themselves powerless and they just don't know how to deal. Mm-hmm. Become neurotic and messed up. Don't know how to deal. Can't put it back together. And I think erasing that ancestral memory has got something to do with it. Mm-hmm. I think it's, you know, because to me, we're being mined. You know, I'm a human being. You're a human. Everybody's a human being. But the bone, flesh, and blood of the human being, the DNA of the human being is made up of the metals, minerals, and liquids of the earth. We're shapes of the earth. Everything of the earth. Everything is a shape of the earth. Right? And we have being, essence, spirit. Everything of the earth, because it comes from the same DNA, has being and essence and spirit. And we live in a reality, a technological perceptual reality, where we understand they can take the DNA of the earth, the metal, mineral, liquid, blood, flesh, and bone of the earth that's called uranium, and put it through a mining process and convert the being part of that uranium into a form of energy. They do it with fossils, and we understand it. And I think that that's what technological Western civilization does, is it mines the being part of human through its processes of domestication, whether it's called patriotism or religion, whatever the hell they call it. These are all just like big earth movers in a way. They're making a lot of noise, just mining, just creating disruption and confusion so that we have no sense of balance within us. See, and then it's almost like chaos starts in an internal combustion engine. You know, we're running a system that is not there to take care of us, is not even concerned. See, we're just disposable. We're being mined. That's my whole... calling us an Indian is a very important mining tool to their system.
I chose that word.
Yes. No, I know.
You've been listening to a conversation between actor, activist Peter Coyote and...